the focus of my talk and of Dan, it's going to be problems of the American left, colon, the cases of Cuba and Nicaragua. And I'm going to speak about Cuba, and Dan is going to speak about Nicaragua. From my point of view, the main problem of the American left in terms of Cuba is the failure to distinguish two quite separate things. One is the opposition to any action, economic, political, and certainly military, that the U.S. may take against the Cuban regime, from the different proposition that the Cuban regime is worthy of political support. One thing does not by any means depend on the other. To begin with, my perspective, as you can already guess, is that the American left should firmly, without any ambiguity, oppose any economic, political, or military effort in the part of the United States, as it's currently the case with the policies that Trump is following, inspired by Marco Rubio and Mr. Bolton, to oppose it without any ambiguity and firmly and oppose it, period. At the same time, I think that that does not imply political support or sympathy for a regime that, by its very nature, is anti-democratic. It's a one-party state, which doesn't mean, as some people think, well, there's only one party running in elections. That's only actually the smaller part of it. The much bigger part of it is it's a party that, through its transmission belts into the so-called mass organizations, trade unions, women's organizations, and other kinds of organizations, and the educational system, its monopoly of the mass media, controls every aspect of Cuban society, or attempts to the maximum degree possible to do so. So that is what a one-party state is. Don't think in electoral terms, think in terms of social and economic and political control. That also means that no independent organization, as was recently shown with the independent gay march in Cuba that took place just a few weeks ago, that was stopped and the people were arrested, no independent organization is allowed. With that in mind, that is, arguing that we should on one hand oppose any attempt to intervene by the United States in Cuba, so that is a history of many decades, and on the other hand, refuse to provide any political support to the Cuban regime. With that in mind, I want to proceed to a brief analysis of why I think are the principal causes, not all the causes, but the principal causes for the stand of the most of the U.S. left on Cuba. At this point in time, in 2019, with more than 60 years actually, exact of the Cuban Revolution, there are relatively few in the U.S. left that remain hardcore supporters of the Cuban regime, and there are not that many that think that Cuba is socialist in the Marxist sense of the term. I think if that's all I was concerned about, I wouldn't even be worthy to give this presentation here. What is far more important, in my opinion, is that the majority of the U.S. left is soft on Cuba. Now, when I say soft on the Cuban regime, what do I mean by that? And taken to its minimal definition, it means that any behavior that the U.S. left would condemn if committed by some other regime is tolerated or excused for by the U.S. left. Any violation of civil liberties, any arrest of dissidents, any of the many actions, harassment of independent organizations that happened, as in the case of the gay march I just mentioned a few minutes ago, that there is a very ingrained tendency in the majority, not all, obviously, and the majority just left to sort of look the other way, excuse it, or apologize for it. Now, that is what I mean, quote unquote, by being soft. I was particularly struck by this softness when how I am, I follow Facebook, you know, I guess that so many of us do, and after the death of Fidel Castro, it was to me shameful the kinds of things that many people on the left were saying about him and the Cuban regime. So, and that's a relatively, he died just a few years ago, so that's a relatively recent example. Then, of course, that doesn't mean, when I say that the Cuban regime shouldn't be supported, that doesn't mean that I refuse to recognize that there are social gains that have been made in Cuba, in education, health, although those are in crisis. As the second point, the second part of my article in Against the Current that is right there on the table, tries to document in detail. The question is, do these social gains, even though they are in crisis, justify support for one party dictatorship, or is the dictatorship necessary to carry out those changes? If that were the case, then we're in deep trouble, my friends. I don't believe that's the case, but that argument would need to be made. Now, what is behind? This is the second part of my talk. I want to try to analyze, provide some of the reasons for what I think, what is behind, what is sort of the structure, the basis for this kind of attitude of softness. Some of it, there are different factors involved, which are more or less relevant with different kinds of people within the left. Some of it is the notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which is very clearly shown in the example of some elements of the American left who have supported the Syrian regime, the criminal Syrian regime, based on the notion, which is, that too is false, by the way, that he was an opponent of the U.S. regime. The Syrian regime provided massive logistical support to the U.S. government after the big offensive after 9/11. So it is not true that that regime was necessarily an enemy of the United States. But that's an example. Assuming it was, that is what some people define as campism. You know, my enemy, anybody who opposes that enemy is therefore my friend. Totally fallacious argument. Closely related to that notion of the enemy is my friend, is the more subtle problem, if you will, that if an imperialist government, I mean ours, is hostile to a foreign government, then we should not, under any circumstances, criticize that foreign government because it is under the attack by the U.S. imperialist government. The question is not that. The question is that we should be able to do two things at the same time. We should be able to, for example, oppose the warmongering of Trump against Iran, has been going for some time, without in any way, shape, or whatsoever apologize for the theocratic regime that exists in Iran. I don't think there is any difficulty involved in such a task. Nonetheless, people again fall for a thing of, you know, keep quiet about Iran now because it is under attack by the U.S. government. I had that experience myself. You know, in the 1980s, I was trying to create a small campaign, given my limited resources and efforts, in behalf of a Cuban left-wing prisoner called Ariel Hidalgo. And I remember calling people I knew that should remain nameless, and they would say to me things. Well, one economist, for example, said to me, I just got back from Nicaragua, and by no means am I going to provide any help to American propaganda vis-a-vis Cuba and so on, because the Nicaraguan regime is going to be in danger. So, well, what about this person that is being unjustly punished? Well, I'm sorry, but I cannot say anything about it. That kind of attitude, I myself, ran into, and that's related to this question of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. another element. They're all related, but I'm trying to separate them so we can talk about one at a time, you know. I don't suggest that they're totally separate in reality, but it's a way of an analysis that tries to identify aspects of the phenomenon. Another element is the third worldism, the ideology of third worldism, which concludes, many people on the left conclude, that political and even moral standards that we would apply to the developed capitalist countries are somehow inapplicable to the actions committed by third world governments. And I think there are many problems with this approach going very, very deep. For example, in the first place, the left tends to see underdevelopment as a dichotomy rather than a spectrum. Now, what do I mean by that? A dichotomy is developed and there's undeveloped. Well, in reality, there is a spectrum, a continuity of degrees of development, and also combined with that, the notion of uneven development. And Cuba is a very good example of that, because pre-revolutionary Cuba was highly advanced in some regards and highly backward in other regards. You see, for example, when it comes to media, Cuba was a pioneer of television in Latin America. The revolution was televised. It was. The television was a powerful organ for the revolutionary government from the very beginning. So, highly advanced in some things and backward, certain rural living standards were shameful in Cuba. That's the only word I can think of. And Cuba is not unique in that regard. So, it is not a dichotomy, it is expected. And combined with this ignorance about the unevenness and nature of underdevelopment, which means that there are different gradations and different things that have to be considered, there is also tremendous ignorance about the countries that people are supposedly supporting in the American left or many other left. I can tell you from personal experience that when I came to this country, right near here, as a temporary student at Illinois Institute of Technology, just 11 blocks from here, I remember I was very offended, actually, when people said to me, well, did you sleep your siesta already, like a nap? Which has also the implication of laziness, by the way. That's like the subtext. And as a matter of fact, I think about 1% of the people that I knew in Cuba slept the siesta. I mean, it was very unusual for people to sleep siestas in Cuba because the two-hour break for morning and afternoon shifts was spent in public transport to go home to have lunch and go back to work. A very impractical system, but it had nothing to do with going to bed. But that is sort of popular ignorance that existed about that. And by the way, a lot of the apologies for the Cuban regime were written with a great deal of ignorance, and the most prominent example of that ignorance is Susan Sontag before she discovered anti-communism. And Susan Sontag, in her article, Some Thoughts on the Right Way to Love the Cuban Revolution, this is Ramparts, April 1969, he says the most incredibly ignorant things about Cuba. There was no literacy in Cuba at all. Well, most people in Cuba were literate. The problem was, again, uneven development. The problem was that while literacy was fairly high in the slightly over 50% of the population that was urban, in the rural sector it was much higher. So, some 25% of the population was illiterate in Cuba, but again, far higher in the rural than the urban sectors. So, and this ignorance leads to the unspoken assumption among people like Sontag in 69 and many others that somehow there are no people like yourselves in Cuba that have some of the democratic aspirations that Sontag supposedly had. So there is this blank that exists about Cuba. Now, how am I doing, by the way? Okay, thank you. Now, closer related to this third worldism, which is again very ignorant a lot of the time, is a particular theory of democracy, whether socialist democracy or bourgeois democracy, that has been developed in large sections of the left concerning who and how can be societies, that is, can be democratic. And this goes along with the notion that is very, to this day, is very, very widespread, that democracy is bourgeois. The degree of democracy we haven't discussed is bourgeois. Now, what they mean by that, a lot of people, is that it is the bourgeois revolutions and bourgeois system that were never revolutionary to begin with. Somehow, it's only a capitalist interest in have democracy, and that in fact, that is not the way. The bourgeoisie can live with democracy or without democracy, and the perfect example of that is apartheid South Africa. Let's say certainly not a democratic system, a goddamn racist system, and the white South African bourgeoisie was able to put up with it very nicely until international pressure of the boycotts that I myself supported and participated in eventually forced the hand of the apartheid government to at least get rid of that audio systems. And in Europe, similarly, the democracy was not a gift that was given by the bourgeoisie to the mass. It was fought for. It was fought for. The Chartist movement, all the struggles throughout Europe, the struggles in the United States, first for manhood, universal suffrage, and then the women's movement obtaining the vote. So it is a process. It is a process of struggle, which means, and extremely important, that when people in Sudan are fighting for democracy, they're rebelling today against dictatorship and suppression and for elementary human and democratic rights. Are we going to say, well, you're not ready for democracy yet because you are very poor and underdeveloped? Well, it may be that if they succeed, they will fail at democracy, but it is trying and trying and trying and trying, and with the social process of development, and of course, helped by material factors. I'm not saying that economic development is irrelevant, not at all. But you can have economic development and have Nazi Germany. So it's a highly complicated process. And the point is that struggles for democracy must be supported. Struggles for freedom, like it's happening right now in Sudan. So this dismissal of, well, we should expect and demand democracy in the developed countries, but when it comes to Cuba and so on, well, they're not ready for it, and therefore we're not going to get too worried about it, and therefore we conclude being indifferent, if not apologizing for the violations of democracy, which of course are essential, not just to for movements to develop, but of course for socialism, whenever a socialist revolution occurs. So therefore, and of course, not only the Sudan, we had the Arab Spring, we have numerous movements for democracy in less developed countries that, of course, we should support. And we should not, if government comes to power in those countries, we will use democratic standards, among other standards, to measure whether that government should be supported or not. So again, I just tried to touch on some points to argue the fact that yes, by all means, we oppose any and all forms of imperialist American intervention in Cuba. We do not, therefore, give political support to the Cuban regime. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your continued cooperation with our struggles with the AV, the audio equipment. Dan Flynn, speak next.
Good morning. It's great to be here and see so many people at this conference and in this room concerned about this subject. And like Sam, I want to talk about the problem of the American left in thinking about and dealing with Nicaragua today. But I want to give a little background from a personal point of view. How many people in this room went to Nicaragua in the 1980s? a few, 1, 2, 3, 4. I was one of those. That is, when the Nicaraguan Revolution occurred, for those of us who are my age, I'm a part of the generation of 1968. And when this revolution occurred, this was a thrilling development to us. We had had hopes in what was happening in France in 68, in the Portuguese Revolution, and what was going on in Italy, things all over Southern Europe, in the fights in South Africa, and the Portuguese colony, former Portuguese colonies in South in Africa, of course. But they had failed. So 1979, here is this revolutionary movement that succeeded. And we were thrilled with it. We wanted to learn about it. Everybody went to the maps to find Nicaragua. Where the hell's Nicaragua? You know, Americans don't know anything about geography in general. We rushed to find out who is this guy Sandino, what is the FSLN, etc. And so this was a tremendous thing for our generation. And I went to Nicaragua with my wife during the Contra War period for a brief time. I don't know if I was there about 2 weeks or something. We carried some medical equipment and some medicine. I went with people from Cook County Hospital who were labor activists in the union there, and we went to take materials to a hospital in Esteli. We tried to get as far as, we went to Matagalpa, we got close to Hinotega, it was the war front, to look for a friend. We couldn't go there because of the helicopters and things. But we were in Nicaragua in that period. And so I want you to know, this, I'm a person who supported that revolution. And of course, we recognize this was a tremendous victory against U.S. imperialism, which had supported the dynastic regime of Somoza there. Generations of Somozas who had run the country, three different presidents, and now they had been overthrown, and we didn't really know what this was, but we wanted to be there. So I just say that so you know I come from a person who supported that revolution and supported what was taking place. Now, and I should add to this, in 2013, I'm an adjunct. You know about adjuncts? Low pay. But somebody said, hey, I need an adjunct to take a group of students to Nicaragua, and you'd be the right person. I said, okay, I'll go. So I went with a group of students to Nicaragua. So I spent 4 months in Managua, and the students were often busy doing other things. They had jobs there and so on. And I partially supervised them. They were partially independent. But I started reading the books, all the memoirs of the people in Nicaragua, and I wrote a book, there's only two copies of this here, and I just bought one so I could show you this. But it's online, it's Haymarket book, it's called What Went Wrong. I hope you'll go buy copies for your friends. Think Christmas will be coming in a while, so I get copies for your friends. So I wrote this book, and in the book I laid out this analysis of what was happening in Nicaragua, the transformation of Nicaragua from what had been a radical experiment in revolution in 1979, the politics of which I'm not going to go into right now, but to it becoming this very authoritarian regime, which was using violence to repress protesters who were protesting, for example, this giant canal that they wanted to build, financed by a Chinese businessman. So then in April of 2018, last year, suddenly there's a popular uprising that begins in Nicaragua. And I'm just going to mention a few things about this. There was a change in the pension system, and it affected both business and working people, but some older people who were waiting for their pensions, who were going to have to contribute more for less, went out to protest. And when they went out to protest, they were protesting at a Social Security office near a university. And the university students came out and joined them, and the police appeared and shot at and fired and killed a number of students. Then there's a Mother's Day protest later, and the mothers come, the mothers who had lost their children, a huge protest demonstration, and the police fire on the demonstration of the mothers who were protesting about their children who've been killed by the police. And then at this point, throughout the country, you know, when you kill people's children, it's like, you know, some of us remember Kent State. You know, you're killing your children. When you're killing your children, the whole society reacts. And so throughout Nicaragua, people put up barricades and roadblocks and tried to take over, tried to stop the regime from doing it. So the regime then, the Ortega government, the Sandinista party in Nicaragua, started sending out not only the police, but thugs who had been used in the past to beat up and harass people in demonstrations. This led eventually over several months to 400 people being killed. It led to thousands of people being wounded, and it led to 50 or 60,000, I think the count is now, people who went to Costa Rica. Now, when you see this kind of thing taking place, you would think that many people in the American left would go, we have to do something about this. This is important. But the left did not react to these events. And I'm sort of asking myself why at the time. I started to run into Nicaraguans in New York. I became friends with them. We started talking about this. But I'm looking out, and there's several things that happened. One is the new left, the people in DSA, I have found, I'm a member of DSA, I've been in there 3 years just before the Bernie bump, as they call it in DSA. So I've been in DSA a while, and I know what's going on there. And the young people there all got radicalized by Bernie and then the fear of Trump, and it's all about domestic politics. Mm-hmm. It's about health care for all. It's about free education and so on. You know, my generation was all about end the war in Vietnam and the civil rights movement. It was a domestic movement, but those two things, civil rights and the war in Vietnam. But the war in Vietnam meant we all became experts on Vietnam. We all went to the library, we had every damn book on Vietnam, everything we could find. And but this young generation doesn't have that experience. It's interested in domestic politics. So within DSA, I found people weren't knowledgeable, didn't have a gut reaction that we had to be there with this. It was a tiny country. And so on. So I did. You know, so I think it's partly that. I don't blame people for being who they are and they're being in their generation. You know, they're new to this, and the question is how to reach them. I would also say that there was a reflex of people of my age, older leftists, and this is true of me. Before I went back in 2013 with that group of students, I hadn't really thought about Nicaragua for a long time, because after Nicaragua, the revolution. Was voted out of office in 1990, we didn't pay much attention to it. And people turned to other things, Brazil, Korea, Poland, other things were happening in the world, and attention turned elsewhere. So we had older people who had been supporters of the Nicaraguan Revolution, who had a perfectly understandable and good reaction in a way. They wanted to be on the side of Nicaragua against U.S. imperialism, like they were in 1979, and I don't blame them either. But I want to challenge them about that. That is, Nicaragua had changed and you weren't paying attention. And it's not bad, it's just life is busy. So let's pay attention now. We have to actually know what we're talking about. A third thing was, and I found this working on issues with the Mexican community in New York and other places I've been working with immigrants, that immigrant communities are often sort of insular. The first place they turn to is their own community. They begin to organize and mobilize their own community, and they haven't been activists, and they don't know how to reach out into the rest of the world. So for lots of reasons, there was little mobilization, and people knew very little facts, and then Venezuela happened. And Venezuela is a big country, it's an important country. U.S. imperialism's role and interest in Venezuela, it's about oil, that was really important. So that then pushed Nicaragua kind of off the map. So I wanted to go back then and say, so for various reasons, things didn't happen. We organized some meetings, we held discussions, some bigger than this, a couple of them in New York. But there's a failure to get a response. And now I want to talk about the reasons that people who supported. There's also a group of people I haven't really mentioned who have the view that Sam described as the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And these people are anti-imperialists, they're opposed to the United States, and the United States has been a terrible imperialist power in Latin America, and so the immediate reaction is, I'm going to support Nicaragua because something bad is going to happen there. Whatever this popular rebellion is, the United States is going to take advantage of it. And what was their arguments? The first thing they said is, U.S. imperialism has been bad. And look at all the things they've done. They overthrew the Arbenz Arevalo government in Guatemala in the 50s. They overthrew the Chilean government. They're constantly involved in all these countries. Look what they've just done supporting the right wing in Argentina and Brazil and so on. You can't argue with any of that. What they said is absolutely true. Everything they said about the U.S. and Latin America is true, but it has nothing to do with Nicaragua. That is, the U.S. was not doing anything at that moment in Nicaragua. Secondly, they said, that for years the United States has given money to and had people that were supporting U.S. interests in Nicaragua. Absolutely true. But this is like, take any country in the world. Anybody shout out the name of a country and I will tell you, the U.S. is there. Don't really shout. But it's a rhetorical device. But any country in the world, if there's a country in the world, the United States has interests there. It has CIA agents there, it's sending money there, somebody from the State Department's going there, if they can get somebody from the AFL-CIO to go along, they'll take them on a trip. That is, this is what governments do. Every government in the world does this if it has enough money and enough resources. So of course the United States had been giving money to Nicaragua, but there's no evidence that any of that money had anything to do with these students who rushed out to support the retirees who were afraid of not having their pensions. Then also, when this happened, right-wing groups immediately did go, you know, to Nicaragua and try to pick a few students and take them to right-wing events in Washington and in Florida. That is, they want to take them to Florida and take them to Washington. And I actually spoke with some students in New York, and people said to me, you spoke with those students, and they went off to talk to the Republicans in Congress. Well, what the hell? They're 18 years old, 20 years old, 22 years old. What the hell do they know? They're from another country, and they want to stop the people killing them there. They don't know about American politics, the Republican Party, Donald Trump. They were kids. Now, did they get manipulated and used? Yes, they did. Am I responsible for that? I'm sorry, I'm not. Should I have been speaking with them? Absolutely. They were the young people who had experienced this violence. Did they have left-wing politics? No. That's another question. I think it is another question that there's virtually no left in Nicaragua. The left is discredited. When you had the Revolutionary Party that said it was socialist, and it becomes an authoritarian party that's pro-business, aligned with the right wing of the Catholic Church, anti-feminist, has the most absolutely awful abortion laws, be a model for Alabama. When you have that government running the country, and you want to come and say, oh, we should have there are little tiny socialist groups in other Central American countries that try to go into Nicaragua and talk to people, but the idea of socialism is utterly discredited. It will have to be, now some of the young students are reading things. Some of the students in Nicaragua, they've been reading things, they're thinking about it, but you can't say, oh, we're supporting Nicaragua because there's a left. And some people say, well, then we should support Ortega because Ortega's better. And their argument is that Ortega is an anti-imperialist. Let me just take that up for a minute. That is, I'm not going to talk about the Nicaraguan Revolution, simply because then we go through two or three more sessions. But what I'd like to do, we'll just say that at the end of the revolution in 1990, they were voted out of office. The U.S.-Contra War had completely exhausted the Nicaraguan people, and the imposition of conscription in Nicaragua to fight the Contra War, people were tired of losing their children, being maimed, injured. They just gave up on trying to continue to fight the United States. They accepted a right-wing government. It was a government chosen by the United States, a woman named Violeta Chamorro, and she became the head of this government. What happened to Ortega and the FSLN after 1990? Because this is actually important to understand if we think about Nicaragua. Ortega and his brother controlled the Sandinista army, which still was in existence, and he controlled the largest delegation in parliament, and there was a one-party state before that of the sort that Sam said, one-party state in the capitalist system, but had that one-party state aspiration. It didn't completely do it in Nicaragua. So they had mass organizations. So Violeta Chamorro could do nothing because they controlled everything and everything else. So they made a deal, but she did have all the international support and international relations and financial interests. So Ortega made a deal with her son-in-law. And the two Ortegas, Daniel Ortega and Humberto Ortega and Antonio Lacayo, who is her son-in-law, the three of them ran Nicaragua for one presidency. And really, during that period, the Sandinistas became transformed. The party leadership became involved in business. They then became allied with the old bourgeoisie in business. They became allied with the right wing of the church. As maquiladoras developed and workers tried to organize, they opposed independent unions and the maquiladoras that existed in Nicaragua, and so on. So in every area of life, the Ortega government became a very conservative force. And it ceased to have anything to do as a revolutionary party. It became an electoral party with an electoral machine, and it had a kind of politics like we're here in Chicago. I was born and grew up a good part of my life here, lived here later. And we had a Chicago type of politics, you know, you'll have your city job if you vote for the party, if you do for the party what you should. You want to get your welfare, you'll vote for the party. That was the kind of mentality that developed. So I think that this notion that Ortega was anti-imperialist. Now, he was a person who continued to get his picture taken with Fidel Castro and Raul Castro. He got his picture taken with Evo Morales, with Hugo Chavez. He was always seen with the rest of the left. He became part of ALBA, the economic network, the alternative economic bank that was created by Hugo Chavez. That money that came, by the way, the money that came in from Venezuela to Nicaragua went to his like personal account. He personally controlled that money. It did not, and he used that money that came from Venezuela. Public workers would get a check, and on the check it would have, like, your paycheck is $25 and $5 from Comandante Ortega. And that was from Venezuela. So this became a very corrupt regime in its relations with the rest of the left. At the same time, the Nicaraguan government, Nicaraguan people were very dependent on foreign aid from other countries. The social democratic governments in Scandinavia continued to support them. Other governments in Europe supported them. So their anti-imperialism, they also got military aid from the United States. And the Drug Enforcement Agency was in Nicaragua, the U.S. Drug Enforcement, with the Nicaraguans' knowledge. The DEA was there, the U.S. military stuff was there. It's on, you can go read about this, look online, you can find out about these arrangements, you can find contracts and things if you're that ingenious. This anti-imperialist government had all these other ties. It's what happens to a tiny country. You know, they have to understand, this is a tiny, tiny country. When we were supporting the revolution in 1979, we were thinking this is the first stage to the building of the socialist states of Central America, right? As you know, in the period of the Russian Revolution, the notion was raised of the socialist states of Europe. There would be a united socialist states of Europe, as there was a union of the Soviet socialist republics in Russia and the former colonies. So this idea, that was the idea of Central America, but that couldn't happen in the circumstances once the United States Contra War had worn that down. But I think it's important to understand that the most important thing I think that indicated all this was that Ortega changed all the laws so he could continue in the presidency forever. He changed the law so his wife Rosario could become his vice president. She waged a campaign against feminism as a Western imperialist plot to conquer the minds of Nicaraguans, and they fought and they allied themselves with the Catholic Church for this reactionary. So I want to wind up here. I want to say, the problem of this has been a lack of interest and understanding, I think, on much of the left. For some people, a romantic view, which I totally understand and sympathize with, of wanting to continue to support the country that had been the revolutionary beacon to us. But this problem of the enemy of my enemy politics is really key here, this campist idea that you have to be supporting Ortega because the United States, you think, doesn't like him. Actually, he got along fine with him. And I agree with Sam, this very condescending notion that there must be a U.S. plot. Could people in Nicaragua just do this themselves? I mean, would all these, this is the biggest demonstration in the history of Central America, Nicaragua. 500,000 people out of 6 million. How many people would that be here in the United States? I mean, somebody do the math.
50 million.
Thank you.
Plus.
Damn, you people who can do math are so impressive. imagine if we had a demonstration of 50 million people in the United States, right? That they had a demonstration of that size in their country, 500,000 against this. So I think that we have to say that you can't have this condescending. People were fighting, they were learning, they were building their own movement, they're trying to figure out where to go. The problem there was the control of the business interests and the control of the right wing of the Catholic Church. And what should our position be on this? One, when there's a rebellion like that, we're on the side of the people. And I'm not ashamed to say people. Yes, we'd like to see the working class get to be the center of that. But when the people are in rebellion, all of the people, the bourgeois people, the petty bourgeois people, against a terrible authoritarian murderous government, I'm on the general side of the people's movement. Within it, I want to fight for a working class alternative. But the workers there have been, controlled and have been smashed. And not only a working class alternative, but a revolutionary socialist point of view among them. And we have to support them as they try to work that out. And we have to encourage a Nicaraguan left. And so I leave you with that thought, and I'm glad you're all here this morning.